Okay, so today we're going to give the construction and properties of beta. So this is the invariant that that helps solve the triangulation conjecture with so it's a map from the homology cobordism group to Z. So let me recall what we did last time. So given a homology sphere Y and the metric G, so H1 of Y is 0, we had some approximation of the Seiberg-Witten flow for tau much less than 0 and much less than nu. And we got out of it some space, the Kalle index, I nu tau. And the homology of this appropriately shifted gives us Seiberg-Witten flow homology. So in fact, we can construct a spectrum invariant, which is a formal disuspension of a space. So it was sum of minus eta over 2c sigma of minus v0 tau I nu tau. So this is the space, the Kalle index, and we're disuspended appropriately according to the eigenvalues between tau and 0, and then we're putting an extra term to take care of the spectral flow between different metrics, and the end result is something that is invariant. It's independent of the metric and the approximation. So the Seiberg-Witten, so if G is S1 or P2, so maybe I should say this is with the S1 equivariant version. If we want to take into account the P2 version, we would consider eta over 4 times H, where H is the quaternionic representation of P2. So we're disuspended by something correspondent to the to spinors, and the P2 groups act on spinors as it by copies of the quaternionic representation. So I will explain in a moment what eta is. So if we have G equals S1 or P2, we can define the Seiberg-Witten flow homology, the G equivariant Seiberg-Witten flow homology of Y, as just the reduced Borel equivariant homology of SWF of Y. All right, so now we want to get a numerical invariant out of these two homologies. If you recall from the first lecture, I said that from the S1 theory, Froeschow defined an invariant, and then from the P2 theory, you can get this beta. So let me first say in more detail what eta is. So eta controls the spectral flow of the Dirac operator. It's given by eta of yg1 minus eta of yg0 as you move between two metrics. And, there are various formulas for eta, so you can think of it as a combination of eta invariants from Riemannian geometry is minus eta of the Dirac operator plus the dimension of the kernel of the Dirac operator, if it has any kernel, plus eta of the signature operator divided by 4. This is on Y. And this combination ends up being, if my manifold is a homology sphere, this ends up being an even integer. No, this is in 3 dimensions. Yes, this is all in 3 dimensions, but it has perhaps a better formula is in terms of 4 dimensions. So eta is 2, is twice the index of the 4-dimensional Dirac operator plus the signature of W divided by 8, where W is any spin compact-oriented four-manifold with boundary Y. So you can always find such a four-manifold, then you can define a Dirac operator with Atiyah, Patodi, Zinger boundary conditions. Yes, this is another formula for eta. So somehow this quantity does not depend on W, it just depends on Y, and the metric, it of course also depends on the metric on Y. Yes?
What's the eta significance?
What's eta of the... So I didn't define the eta invariance, but yes, you have... Let me say what it is. So you have a self-adjoint operator. In this case, it's star D minus D minus D star 0 from omega 1 of Y plus omega 0 of Y to itself. Yes, it kind of controls the signature on. It corresponds to the term in the Atiyah Patodi Zinger formula, where you look at the signature operator for manifolds, so the signature for manifolds with boundary. So this is what the usual signature operator is D plus D star, and then if you look at it on Y times R, it becomes D over dt plus this operator on Y. Okay, and to every self-adjoint operator, you can define the eta invariant as the sum of over the eigenvalues of the sine of the eigenvalue divided by lambda to the s, and then you analytically continue at s equals 0. But actually, I don't want to get too much into these formulas. The thing to remember is that this is an even integer. And furthermore, what we see from here is, this is also even because this is spin, so this is quaternionic. So this is because of the quaternionic structure of the spinor bundle on the four-dimensional manifold. So what we get is that eta is not only even, but we can tell what it is congruent to mod 4. It's, 2 times, it's sigma of W over 4 mod 4. And let's recall the definition of the Rochlin invariant is just... It's of the same thing. It's the signature of a spin manifold with boundary y divided by by 8 mod 2. So this is mu of y, and it's either 0 or 1. It lives in z mod 2. So what we see is that this eta is, in fact, congruent to 2 mu of y mod 4. So when we move the metric, the Dirac operator has some eigenvalues that cross 0, but since it's quaternionic, whenever they cross it in, dimension something whose dimension is divisible by 4. So its reduction mod 4 is independent of the metric, and indeed it's twice times the Rochlin invariant.
Do you ever need to use the sort of actual construction of eta in terms of spectral asymmetry, or just, is this index formula sort of all that you have?
Yeah, that's all I want to know. That's all I need to know, yeah. You have to know that that this is independent of W. So one way to do that is to use Atiyah Patodi Zinger.
So 8 over 2 is an integer lift of the Rochlin invariant.
That is true, except, so that would be nice, except that it depends on the metric. Yes, so it is, but we want a 3-manifold invariant. In fact, we want something on theta 3h. So our eta does depend on the metric. So the kind of the problem is to make it an invariant of the manifold, to not depend on the metric.
So there's a sort of just a chamber structure in the space of metrics?
Yes. And they differ by 4 or 8.
And is it just a... there's just a sort of natural parameterization of chambers as essentially labeled by integers?
Oh.
Somehow that's what Freyshoff did in his construction of Monopole.
Yes, that's true. I think there is so I'm not too familiar with this. I mean, I think there are some results that say that yes, that when that you know, the Dirac operator only crosses zero in some codimension, and you get these chambers, and you can attain all the values. Maybe can you attain all? No. I think the way Freyshoff did it was by perturbations by a form, rather than perturbing the metric.
It was an exact form as well.
Yes. I think it's hard to study what happens with the metric, like to actually understand all the metrics.
But I thought somehow the idea was that the kitchen has some very explicit construction on the three-sphere involving a family of metrics.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can kind of glue that onto your manifold.
Oh, really? I don't know. That's possible. So can you get any value you want?
I think in some sense that's what Freyshoff proves. But I don't know the precise statement.
Okay. That's possible. Yeah, I'm not too familiar with what he does, but he definitely uses the perturbation to reduce to the case when you don't have reducibles. So. Okay, so anyway, right, so with this in mind, so let's see what is the structure of the Seibert-Guittenfleur homology. So let's start with the S1 equivariant case. So let's assume we do have transversality. As I said, the main advantage of this spectrum construction is that you don't have to assume transversality, and in fact for Pintu I wouldn't know how to do it, but let's say that we had it. And in fact, like if we're in something like Kronheimer-Morovka or Freyshoff's setup. So then, we would have a chain complex depending on the metric. So the homology should not depend on the metric, but the chain complex does. And, it's generated by solutions to the Seibert-Guittin equations. And there are two kinds of solutions. Reducible and irreducible, according to what their stabilizer is. So the a reducible solution, this is in fact unique in this case, when it's a homology sphere, it's one on which S1 acts trivially. And an irreducible is when it acts by a free orbit. So this corresponds to phi equals 0, and this corresponds to phi non-zero. And if phi equals 0, then you automatically get A equals 0 as well. Or if you do some perturbation, then you get A equals something else. But there's a unique solution like this, and then there are several irreducible solutions. So in the complex, each of them contributes the corresponding equivariant homology of the orbit. So, So the reducible... let me draw it here. We have a reducible and a bunch of irreducibles. The reducible contributes the equivariant homology of a point, and these each contribute the equivariant homology of a circle. Let's again work with Zeeman 2 coefficients for simplicity, and let's recall that our homology is an S1 equivariant homology, so it should be a module over the S1 equivariant cohomology of a point, which is the cohomology of CP infinity, which is f of u with u in degree 2. So this is this comes from CP infinity. So we should have an action, by the cap product, so u should decrease degree by 2. And this, the equivariant, this should be homology, the equivariant homology of a point, and the equivariant homology of S1. This is just homology. Why am I writing cohomology? It's the homology of CP infinity, so it's something like F0, 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 F, and so on. And the U action brings the M, just goes like this, as the cohomology of CP infinity acts on the homology of CP infinity. And then each of these just gives us a copy of F. So, write something like this. Maybe we have one more. Let's put one more. Okay, you can also act on the irreducibles. Maybe we could have things like, let's put the F here, and this is an F. So we could have U like this. We could even have a map, a U map from the reducible to the irreducible. And the other thing that can happen, I mean, of course, so these are the generators of the complex. It has a module structure, and it also has a differential. So we could have differentials between irreducibles or between reducible and irreducible. Okay, so this is the complex. The important thing to notice is that it has this this single U tail, infinite tail, and the rest is something finite. Okay, now, maybe I should say one thing. This is if you assume transversality. If we don't, like if we are in my setup, then you can still show that the homology. All right, so this is the complex. Then we can take its homology, and some things cancel out. So, for example, here, this would cancel with one of these, and these cancel by the differential. So you end up with homology. So from here you get SWFH S1 of Y. It has an infinite, it still has an infinite U tail. So what I wanted to say is that if you don't know about, if you don't want to deal with transversality, you can still show that the homology has this structure, namely a U-tail and something finite. And the way to prove this is by the localization theorem in equivariant cohomology. So the localization theorem tells you that when you invert U, you get the contribution from the fixed point set, and you can study the fixed point set of the Conley index, and that exactly corresponds to the reducible. You can actually show that the fixed point set of that is a sphere. So maybe, so I nu tau, the fixed point set, you can show that this is basically just a contribution from the reducible, which ends up being a sphere, and it's exactly of dimension V0 tau. So it's I'm writing this as this vector space compactified at one point. The reason is this, because it's because near the reducible, these are the dimensions where you get a negative eigenvalue, and that contributes to the Morse index. So by studying the fixed point set, it's kind of the same as studying the reducible, and you can prove just without using transversality that the homology has this form. Okay, so now let's get to the grading. We want to give a grading to this. So the natural definition was to was for the grading to shift the grading of I nu tau by minus v0, the dimension of v0 tau, and then by this a tau over 4. So this contributes on the level of the fixed point sets. This, we are desuspending it. We end up with S0 when we do this. So this is kind of the fixed point. And then we're doing this again. So therefore, we don't want the reducible to sit in degree 0. We exactly want it to be in degree eta. So that's why the natural absolute grading on Seiberg-Witten-Fleur homology is to set the lowest degree of the U-tail in the complex in degree eta. Okay, and eta is congruent, so as I said here, this eta is congruent to 2 mu mod 4. That depends on the metric, and the complex depends on the metric. So, to get some invariant that does not depend on the metric, you have to look at a similar thing, but in homology instead of the chain complex. So, if we look in homology, then some of these things. So the tail can get shorter, as it does in this case, pictured here, or you can actually get longer if you have some U map from this F to somewhere else, and you don't have a differential, then it could get longer. So Freyshov defined so let me choose my favorite normalization of the Freyshov invariant delta. To delta, which is, let me call it D, to be the lowest degree of the U-tail in the S1 equivariant Seiberg-Witten-Fleur homology rather than in the chain complex. So what we know about D is that, D is still even. But unrelated to mu, to the Rochlin invariant, unlike eta. So eta is congruent to 2 mu mod 4, but then here we could just cancel the lowest term, and then we end up with this in 2 mu plus 2 mod 4, or we may not. So maybe it would be good to see an example. Let's do some examples. Actually, the simplest example is S3. S3 has a single reducible and no irreducibles. So we just have this tail, and in this case we have that eta is 0 and also d is 0. So the Rochlin is 0, and in this case there's no problem, so delta is also 0, the Freyshov invariant. But if you look at the Briskorn sphere, such as sigma 2, 3, 11, this is perhaps the clearest example. For sigma 2, 3, 11, you have exactly this tail, and these two, you have two irreducibles, and the differential maps them like this, exactly how I drew it over there. And in this case, eta is still 0, so you can pick a metric if you kind of compatible with the Seifert vibration, then eta becomes 0, so the Rochlin invariant is also 0, but d is 2. And in this case, delta, the Freyshov invariant, is equal to 1. So it's unrelated to mu. But in this case, they are the same. So in general, you cannot say anything. Okay, so this was the definition of the threshold invariant. Now, well, I want to move to beta, so I have to study the structure of the Pinto equivariant. Flat homology.
So in your spectrum, I guess the grading is just there.
The grading is just there, yes, exactly.
In the cohomology.
Yes.
In the homology.
Yes. Okay, so this is going to be similar, so it should be a module this time over the equivariant cohomology of a point. Okay, so maybe I should say what that is with with Z mod 2 coefficients. Well, pin 2 is a subgroup of SU2 of the unit quaternions. So recall that pin 2 is S1 union S1 times J inside the union quaternions. It's made of two circles. If you divide SU2 by a circle, you end up with S2, and then you divide it by Z mod 2, and you end up with RP2. So if you have a diagram of vibration of groups like this, you get one of classifying spaces. Namely, you get that BP2 is a RP2 bundle over BSU2, and BSU2 is HP infinity. It's the quaternionic, infinite quaternionic projective space. So if you have this, then automatically you know the cohomology of BP2 from the Lorentz spectral sequence. So right. So let me write the spectral sequence. Basically, I write the cohomology of HP infinity here, which is something like this. It's 4-periodic, and the cohomology of RP2 here. It's FFF. That's it. It's so let's call this V and let's call this Q. So V is in degree 4 and Q is in degree 1, and Q cubed equals 0, because that's what happens for RP2. And there can be no higher differentials in this spectral sequence. So, well, with some work you can figure out the ring structure. It's just generated by Q and V. So it's a polynomial ring in Q and V in degrees 1 and 4, modulo the relation that Q cubed is equal to 0. Okay. Yes. Wait. What's the cohomology of RP2 with coefficients in Z mod 3?
Actually, the way I was thinking of it was that you have pin 2 has a normal subgroup S1 and quotient Z mod 2, so you can use the Hochschild spectral sequence for that. And so then that's sort of no torsion along the bottom, but I think. But cohomology of RP infinity up the side, I think. But if I use non prime, I guess the cohomology of RP infinity disappears.
That's possible. Sorry, I would have to think about it. The thing I thought about is with rational coefficients, and with rational coefficients, you just get this, and you get one invariant. That's not as good. So somehow Z mod 2 is better.
Another prime, perpetual of the system.
Yes, yes, so I think you get one in one tail. Yeah, you get one tail. Just like for Q. Okay. Okay, so in this case, well, what happens? So, right, so here we would consider, so now we still have reducibles and irreducibles, but we should think of the irreducible as coming in pairs related by the action of J. So this would be an irreducible is a copy of pin 2. Now, I mean, two previous irreducibles now form one orbit under pin 2. And then pin 2 acts trivially here, so we would just get the homology of pin 2, the equivariant homology of a point. So here we would get the homology of this space, which is something like FFF0, FFF0, and so on. And here we just get one copy of F for each of them. And we can still have differentials, and we could still have maybe Q actions or V actions. We could have many things. I guess previously I didn't draw them in pairs. In principle, they have to come in pairs. So we could have like a Q action or a V action or a differential between them. Many things can happen. What we're mostly interested in this tail. So we have, well, this is the action of Q. We don't really care that much about the action of Q. The action of V decreases grading by 4. So with respect to V, there are 3 tails. So we get 3 infinite V tails. And when you take homology, again, some of the things cancel. Now, again, the way we define this from the spectrum, it's just the same as before. So this would still end up in degree eta, the bottom one in the chain complex. And once again, you can show that the homology has this form without doing any transversality. It just follows from algebraic topology and the localization theorem. Now, what happens is that you define the bottom degrees in homology. Let's say there will be A, B, and C congruent to 0, 1, and, sorry, they're going to be congruent to mu plus 1, sorry, eta plus 1, and eta plus 2, all mod 4. Because, so the bottom tail would be congruent to eta mod 4. Some of the things may be canceled by reducible or made bigger, but it's going to be the same mod 4. B is going to be eta plus 1, and C is going to be eta plus 2. So now we're going to define some new invariants. We have 3 of them. Let alpha be A over 2, beta be B minus 1 over 2, and gamma be C minus 2 over 2. And now they are all congruent to eta over 2, which is mu mod 2. So they lift the Rochlin invariant. Great. So let's look at an example. Let's look at this sigma 2, 3, 11. So I said that here you have one reducible and 2 irreducibles. So on the pin 2 side, we have exactly F, 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 0, F, 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 0, and so on. And we have one single F that cancels this F on the bottom. So the bottom degrees in the 3 tails are here, here, and here. So this is A is equal to 4, B is equal to 1 and C is equal to 2. So if you look at those renormalizations, we end up with alpha equals 2, gamma equals 0, and beta equals 0. And the good thing is that now they are all even. They have the same parity as the Rochlin invariant, unlike the Frouchov invariant delta, which was 1. So somehow this gives you more refined information instead of, actually it gives you different information. Instead of this 1 invariant, instead of 1, you got 0, 0, and 2 by taking into account this extra symmetry. Yes?
So
this is like a pin to L space.
Is there anything interesting about this in the sense that there's no reduced homology here? No finite piece?
Oh, that is true.
So it looks sort of like the Fleur homology of S3, basically.
Well, except it doesn't, right? Because that one, the tails come together. Yes, that's right. There's no finite piece left over in homology. So in the S1 equivariant case, there's this concept of L spaces, which means that there's no finite thing. Everything is just one tail. And that's useful. There's a lot of theorems about L spaces. I don't know if being like this is any good. That's a good question. Okay, so this was the definition. Now let's see, I have 22 minutes. Let me talk about the properties that we need to establish. So there's just two of them. So the first one is that they have something to do with homology cobordism, namely all of them, in fact, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta descend to theta 3h. So if y0 and y1 are homology cobordism, they have the same invariants. This was first done by Frouchov for delta, and the proof is similar, adapted to my setting for the others. And second is the duality, so also Frouchov showed that delta of minus y is minus delta of y. Now what happens with alpha, beta, and gamma is that alpha of minus y is minus gamma of y, beta of minus y is minus beta of y, and gamma of minus y is minus alpha of y. So alpha and gamma get switched under orientation reversal, and that's why they're not as useful as beta for our purposes. What we needed from beta was that it descends to homology cobordism and that it has this property. Okay. So let's discuss homology cobordism. Well, this has to do with the TQFT properties of Seiberg-Witten theory. So what happens is that if you have, in fact, any cobordism from y0 to y1, yes, of course, so you have to, well, yes, to really see the spin structure better, this better be, for pin 2, this better be spin. But yes, for S1 it doesn't have to be. So what Okay, and let's say for simplicity that B1 of W is 0. Just for simple, I mean, you can do it otherwise as well. Then you can study the Seiberg-Witten map on W and do finite dimensional approximation to this. So this is similar to what Voruta did in four dimensions for closed manifolds. So what you end up with is a map between the corresponding spectra. So SWF of Y0 is going to map to SWF of Y1, except that there will be a shift in dimension corresponding to invariance from beta. So in this case, you get, well, a suspension by n copies of R tilde. And here you get a suspension by m copies of the quaternionic representation, where m is equal to sigma, the signature of W over 8, and n is b2 plus of W. So let me remind you, I'm thinking about P2 representation. H are the quaternions, and R tilde is the sine representation, corresponding to spinors and forms. Of course, if we just care about homology cobordism, then we don't need to care. Then these invariants are zero. So if W is has the homology, it's a homology cobordism, that means that it has the homology of S3 times an interval, then that means that M equals N equals zero. So you just get a map between between these two spectra, and correspondingly you get a map between the two homologies. So let's see what happens on the PIN2 case. So you get a map from the Seiberg-Witten-Fleur homology, let's say PIN2 equivariant of Y0 to that of Y1. Well, right. So this one is something like FF. Well, it has some tail, FF0, FFF, and so on. And it has some finite stuff. And this also has some tails. And some finite stuff. And we're interested in the bottom degrees. So let's say that this tail was bigger. I don't know, one of them. Let's say the top one was bigger. Well, one thing you can study is what happens on the reducibles. So you can use the localization theorem again. To study what happens, I mean, to basically just restrict this map to reducibles, and reducibles are easy to understand, even on four dimensions, they just correspond to phi equals zero, and in this case there's a single reducible, and what this tells you that is that this map is an isomorphism. All right, so basically this map, let me call it FW, is an equivalence. FW restricted to the fixed point set is an equivalence. And the homology of the fixed point set is exactly captured by these tails. So what happens is that in large degrees, you can show that this map is an isomorphism, is the identity.
Does the same thing happen if you have B2 plus?
No, then it's zero. Yes. It's exactly non-trivial when B2 plus is zero. Okay, but then, well, so you know what it is up here. Now here there's some interaction, and you don't quite know what it is, but there is one thing you know, namely that if this is an isomorphism, and this is the V action, That's no problem. That's no problem. Sorry. Let me try it again. If the V-tail is longer here, then this is an isomorphism, and this is the V-action, and this is a module map. But here, V is taken to zero. So we would get a contradiction. So the module structure, from the module structure, what we get is that the tail here cannot be longer than any of the tails, than the corresponding tail on the domain. So that means that alpha, for example, in this case, I guess I'm looking at the top tail, it would mean that gamma of y0 should be less or equal than gamma of y1. Yes, it works for all of them. So alpha, all of them, alpha, beta, gamma, delta of y0 is less or equal than the corresponding alpha, beta, gamma, delta of y1. But now what we can do is just reverse the cobordism and change its orientation at the same time. We get a cobordism from y1 to y0, and it's still a homology cobordism. It still has zero homology, so you get the inequality the other way, so you get equality. And that shows that alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are the same if the manifolds are homology cobordant. All right. So the second question, the second property that I want to get into is duality. So what happens when we reverse the orientation of the manifold? Well, our invariants were defined using the Seiberg-Witten flow, and the Seiberg-Witten flow for minus y is just the reverse of the one for y. So, yes, you can check that basically the only thing that happens is that it's the same flow, the same critical points, but it changes direction if you keep the same metric. So if we're looking at our construction of the Cauley index, so the Cauley index for y, well, I nu tau, was something like n mod l, where n was, so we were looking at all these flow lines, and n was some neighborhood, which we could even take to be a ball, and then l was the exit set. Okay. But now we can also look at l prime, which is the entry set. The entry set, so L union L prime is the boundary of M, and L prime is the part where the flow enters the neighborhood. But if you look at the reverse flow, then L and L primes are switched. So L prime becomes the exit set. So what we have is that I of minus y is N divided by L prime. So now, well, an exercise in topology tells you that spaces like this, if you do n mod l and n mod l prime, where the union of l and l prime is the boundary, are Spanier-Whitehead dual. With respect to n. So this is, let me remind you, so Spanier-Whitehead duality is a version, well, it's related to Alexander duality. So, Alexander duality has to do with if you have a subspace of Sn, and you look at its complement, then the homology of one is equal to the cohomology of the other, such that the sum of the degrees is n minus 1. Here, they can be related to that. The homology of one is the cohomology of the other, such that the sum of the degrees is the dimension of n in this case. But we can say more. So then you can also do all of these suspensions, and what you end up with is that Seiberg-Witten f of y of minus y is the dual to Seiberg-Witten f of y. And basically, by doing these suspensions, you kind of normalize everything so that the sum of the dimensions is in degree zero. So one thing that you get is that if you want the homology of what is the property for x and the dual of x in spectra is that the homology of x is the cohomology of the dual of x in degree minus k. So, for example, the five-dimensional sphere is dual to the minus five-dimensional sphere. All right, so this already allows you to relate, say, the non-equivariant Seiberg-Witten Fleur homologies of minus y and y. They're very simply related, but what we care about are the equivariant homologies. So, how are the equivariant homologies of dual spaces related? Could it be, so if I have x and dx related by duality, could we have that the Borel homology of G is minus H of minus G star of x? That cannot be true. This is bad. I mean, it's not true because why? Because this has an infinite tail in the positive direction, going to plus infinity. And this has an infinite tail in the negative direction. Because, homology and cohomology are about the same, especially if you work with coefficients in a field. But if I do equivariant homology, I get this infinite tail coming from the homology of BG. And here I get the same tail, but I'm reversing the sign of the degrees. So I get one I get that this is bounded above and this is bounded below. So they're definitely not going to be equal. However, they are related by the Tate exact sequence. Maybe I should give some other Tate Swan exact sequence, maybe. It's used in equivariant homotopy theory. So the way it works is that we have a long exact sequence, CH star G of X, TH star G of X, and H star G of X. This is the usual Borel homology of X. This is called the Tate homology, and this is called the Coborel homology. And the Coborel homology is actually what you would expect by duality, so it's H minus star G of X. Of T of X. So instead of this being equal to this, what happens is that they have something in common. They are connected through the Tate homology. The Tate homology is, what should you know about it? So this is equal to zero when g is one. So that's what happens in the non-equivariant case. This term disappears, and the two are just equal. I should mention there's also some shift in grading that I'm not keeping track of, but it's there. And in general, it's non-trivial, but in general, in this case, it only depends on, well, let's say if, well, in our case, it only depends on the fixed points. So basically, when the space is semi-free, it just has free and trivial orbits, then it just depends on the fixed point set. And the fixed point set, we know what it is, it's just a sphere. So this middle term, it doesn't depend on our space. What it is just it's made out of the two infinite tails. So it's an infinite tail in both directions. So let me give you a scheme of how this exact sequence works in our case. Okay, so we're going to have over here, we're going to have this, the usual Borel homology, which I said it has these tails, and it has some finite stuff. So this is Borel. We're going to have Tate and Coborel. And Coborel is the same thing, but now things are going down. So it's something like F0, FFF, let's say 0, FFF, and so on, plus some finite stuff. And then in the middle is the Tate homology, and the Tate homology doesn't depend on our manifold. It's always the same thing. It's the Tate homology of a sphere. It's basically an infinite triple tail in both directions. So the fact that these are related by this long exact sequence tells you that, these things are isomorphisms in high enough degree. And what happens is that this finite stuff is connected to this finite stuff by the connecting homomorphism. And from the fact that it's a long exact sequence, you get that at some point this becomes... this stops being an isomorphism, and it has to start being an isomorphism here. So this allows you to relate the size of the tails for y with the one for minus y. So what you get is that, for example, well, basically wherever this tail ends, so this would be, say, gamma of y, the top tail here has become the bottom tail here. So this becomes minus alpha of minus y. So this is why things are reversed, because we are reversing the degree in cohomology when we are looking at the dual. And the result is that, as I said, alpha of minus y is minus gamma of y, but the middle tail gets preserved. So beta of minus y is equal to minus beta of y. Okay, and that's establishes the properties we wanted. Yes?
These homology cohomologies, they behave nicely under
connex sum? No. Well, not as easily. I mean, maybe they have some behavior, but they are not additive. You can show by counterexamples. Yes?
So if we use the S1 theory and we look at these cohomologism maps that you're talking about, then you can reconstruct the Seiberg-Witten invariants. So what happens if I use the pin 2? Do I get some new, like, 3 pin 2 Seiberg-Witten invariants or something like that?
No. So you should just get the... I mean, you should get a pin. You should get the count of Seiberg-Witten solutions modulo pin 2, and that should be exactly the Seiberg-Witten invariant divided by 2.
But it seems like you'd get three different invariants.
Yes, I think they would be all the same. That's right. So you're thinking of how it's done in Heegaard-Fleur. Okay, I haven't thought about it, but my guess is that, I mean, if you think of the Seiberg-Witten case, then the thing you should get is the pin 2 count of Seiberg-Witten solutions.
So this question, I mean, might belong better tomorrow, but anyway. So in four dimensions, you're saying, you know, one can look at these two Seiberg-Witten invariants as Morgan and Szabo and successors did. And, you know, the most striking thing that's been established there is that they sort of give you obstructions to having symplectic manifolds of various homotopy types with C1 equal to 0. So I wondered whether you've thought about whether there are interesting directions sort of connecting that idea to stuff happening in three dimensions. For instance,
yes, no, I have
structures with C1 equal to 0.
Oh, sorry, what kind of structures?
Contact structure.
Contact structure with C1 equal to 0. Oh, no, that's a good question. Yes, I haven't thought about it, but it sounds potentially good. Yes.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank Chipian again.